Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer. Chris,
heck yeah,
who's in the studio today?
Absolutely nobody.
Oh, just perfect.
Just Dave and I, which is nice. You know, some people write in to say they like these shows. Everybody likes all the shows, but sometimes it's nice just to keep it in house here.
100% engagement on every show.
And as you know, the Meat and Potatoes of Shop Talk Show is listener Q&A. And of course, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that you just head over to shoptalkshow.com and there's a big old button that says ask a question and you can send one in, which is kind of the, like I said, meat and potatoes, but the heart of Shop Talk Show. That's what we've kind of always done here. Less of an interview show and more of a let's answer your questions. So keep those coming in. We love to have them. We have one here from James Hammond who wrote in with us. You know, it was kind of a long one, and we can't read always super long emails on the show, but it was kind of describing the system by which is using WordPress and using the block editor Gutenberg, you know, on WordPress, which mm-hmm. I feel like could be an interesting topic for the show anyway. I feel like these block editors are everywhere these days. The web has kind of decided that block editors are the cool way to do editors these days. But anyway.
One stepping stone on the path to Dreamweaver
4.0. Do you think it'll come all the way back full circle?
It's gonna, dude. It's gonna. Anyway.
That's hilarious. But anyway, so, you know, when you have a block with an editor, you can kind of programmatically describe that block, which I think is appealing to, I don't know, JavaScript nerds, because they're like, oh, cool, I can have an array of objects, then each one is a block, and then my drag and drop schema will, you know, fit with that nicely and yada, yada, yada. Well, in WordPress, you can also do additional things. You could say there's like an API that says, tell me all the blocks that are on this page. And so James has wired up something that he's not only, you know, dropping these blocks on the page through WordPress, but he's styled each block so that each block has its own set of CSS that goes with it. Ooh. And then he's got some way that he can be like, okay, what blocks are on the page? Got it. Give me the CSS for each one of those blocks, which is a minimal set of CSS, and then I'll drop that in my critical CSS in the head, which is like, wow, that's some fancy.
Whoa, this is like CSS in PHP. This is awesome. This is it. This is what you want. I think this is incredibly clever.
I just think it's interesting of all the different ways that people do it. First, it definitely requires some fancy dancing. Like WordPress isn't going to help you with this. You're kind of on your own here.
Right. You have to associate blocks to styles, right? Like WordPress isn't like, here's the exact styles you need.
There probably is a way to code it though that where it's not too bad, you know, like if all your code for a block is in one place, I'm sure there's a way to put your styles there too and namespace it in such a way that works for you or something. It doesn't help you with like, because Gutenberg's just the content area. It's not going to help you with your header and your sidebar or whatever else too. So it doesn't solve the whole critical CSS issue, but it is cool, you know.
I have an ignorant question. Can I ask? How granular is it? Is a paragraph a P block? Is an image a
totally.
Image block?
Yep.
Or is it like I have text blocks and then I have other blocks? How does that make sense?
There's so many blocks. But I mean, out of the box, there's dozens, I think. But yeah, a paragraph is a block.
So it's just like Notion. I'm familiar. I use Notion.
Yeah.
And it's like every line, every time I hit return, I'm basically writing a new field in a database.
Right. But also imagine that it's extensible as heck. And you know, WordPress, when people get the power to do extensible things, they do it.
Yeah. So if I could write plugins for Notion, it would be like that. These are apples and oranges, but like,
right. And you know what Notion doesn't have is like settings for a block. So, you know, like it kind of does. Like you could set the background color of a Notion block, right? You right click and you get a context menu and you can pick a color for the text or the background of it. That's kind of like a setting, but imagine instead that when you have that block selected, you have a whole sidebar in its drop-down menus and radio buttons and all kinds of stuff. A text input that says, do you want to apply a custom CSS class to this block?
Yeah,
and
custom font to this
block.
Yeah.
And so you can configure not only the block itself, And just to complicate matters a little bit, there's kind of like an onboarding step that you can do for a block. So you can say, before the block gets inserted, answer these questions. Every paragraph.
Hi, it's Clippy. It looks like you're writing a paragraph.
Well, not for every paragraph, but like a custom Google Maps block. Okay. Give me some coordinates, and then I'll drop the block in there, you know, because I can't do anything unless I have the coordinates.
Address or coordinates. Yeah, okay. That's actually
super. And then there's settings on top of that. So this whole thing is like each one of these blocks can be like a whole app practically.
Yeah. 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 Mm. All right. Well, that's
anyway,
cool.
Anyway, that was a lot of stuff there, but it's cool. But it doesn't it get you thinking about like, what if, like, remember that HTTP2 thing? I was blabbing about this the other day where you don't have to do anything special. You just put a link tag right before the block that's links to your style sheet. Then you didn't have to.
Yeah.
Mess about with any fancy build step. It's just right there in your HTML.
I have that on my site, and I'm not sure it's the best loading experience. You know, I'm getting like a, you know, and my site's so small, I could serve all like 5K of CSS in the header if I wanted. But
yeah, this was just an experiment.
It's just, yeah, I was just experimenting with this kind of layered loading, I guess.
I see. You know? Yeah, you got it going on right here. Like right before the footer,
yeah.
There's a link style sheet to footer.css.
Yeah, and there's on the post, there's a link to a post CSS and stuff like that. So I tried it on that. And, you know, but I see a little flash. Like I think Robin Brindle DM'd me, was very concerned, said, hey, on Mobile Safari, I see bold text flash and then your lightweight font comes in, and he's exactly right. Like there's a little flash of fonts like going on, but that could also be my link rel preload for fonts happening, you know.
So that's just fonts though, but isn't the whole point of this that links in HTML are render blocking, so it shouldn't render anything until it has
right CSS? So it must be the fonts coming in like async or something, or it has one font and doesn't have the other. And I also have other problems where, you know, in old Edge, new Edge, which we could talk about, but old Edge will sometimes not load the font. It'll just decide, yeah, I don't need the bold font. I'll do Helvetica or Sago or whatever. So anyway, I like this block, just what you need, but that's, you know, also sometimes it's just give them the content and let the styles come in lazy. That's maybe also my favorite.
We have another one about CSS loading, so maybe we'll get to that either in this show or the next one, because there is a lot to talk about with CSS loading. I feel like there's different ways these days that are all kind of interesting. And it's like, do you actually, I mean, you'd have messed around with it clearly, but I feel like I don't think any of these particular interesting ways of loading CSS have really taken hold.
Yeah, no, I think we're all still doing either mega style in the header or CSS and JS now, which is, you know, little style blocks on each component that have been munged up.
So, yeah, right. That's a whole thing.
But those are two popular paths. I think there's like three or four maybe out there still, you know. But getting that critical CSS going, you know, I struggle with it because you do get the flash, but man, it does make the page feel very fast. Like you get a paint. And actually, you know, I'm working on some sites, you know, my site or, you know, client sites. And actually my biggest issue with rendering is the CSS. Like I've solved all the other issues, you know, there's huge JavaScript issues, but it's like, yeah, that's going to take 10 years to figure out. But the CSS is like, I can, Lighthouse gives you a load impact like assessment. It's like on 3G, it takes 1 second for your CSS to load, and it's red because that's a long time for CSS to load. And so that makes me like, I'm very like numbers video game oriented. If I see those numbers, I'm like, yes, I'm going to win this one. Make it green. I have to win. So for better or for worse, that's if you wanted to game me.
I was on the Zeit docs yesterday, and they have like, you get like points for how much docs you read. And I was like, oh gosh, now I have to read every word of their doc.
I know it's terrible because it's, you know, I'm just a gameable system. I mean, you just show me a number and then show me what number it should be. And I'm like, well, crack my knuckles. I got some time here, what's cool is I can see the impact of my CSS, especially on 3G. You start seeing the speed impact of over serving CSS. So, yeah, anyway, cause it is a blocking file. It's a big impact. It's a big hit. So,
yep. Okay. Well, interesting stuff, James, you know, like definitely consider your technical debt with all of this, you know, which is, I guess a word that gets thrown out a lot, but I think about a lot where you're like, have you engineered this to the point where it's going to become a pain in the ass?
Yeah.
That's or is it a set it and forget it kind of feature?
You know? Yeah. I mean, but especially with blocks, right? Like the future is you know, Joe from the office can install whatever plugin, the Dribbble plugin that has a Dribbble block. You know, did you account for the CSS there? You know, like if you're managing it, awesome. Awesome. But is it like, does it work when 3,000 people are using your CMS? I don't know. So
I was just fighting some CSS loading this morning in WordPress because I was like, I used the WP and Q style in a way that I thought was normally the way to do it. And it loaded up the CSS okay, but it decided to put it in the footer. And I was like, that's a weird place to put it. Like, I guess it's not render blocking, but I definitely see a massive flash of style thing here, which I don't like. Mm-hmm. And I was like, why is it doing that? Like, so I tried, but I put the WP and Q style in the page template itself. And I was like, I wonder if it's like that is executing too late for it to into the header.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like you can't put it in WP head because WP head has already ran.
Yeah, I don't know.
So like I tried moving it around and anyway, then Dave, you're like, let's do the show. And I was like, okay.
So I stopped working on it 3 months later.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by ImageKit.io. If you're looking to optimize the images on your website or app to improve performance, page load time, and SEO, then ImageKit.io is a complete solution for this. ImageKit offers real-time image optimizations and transformations with a global content delivery network, making image management and optimization really, really simple. Using ImageKit will allow you to deliver great user experience and much better SEO for your project. You can integrate ImageKit with just about any platform, AWS S3, Magento, WordPress, Shopify, and just about anything else. And with ImageKit, you get great features like automatic format selection, compression, resizing, smart cropping, and more. They've got some great custom integrations like using ImageKit with custom domain names, using your own CDN with ImageKit for transformations and optimizations, and dedicated infrastructure setup for enterprise clients. And with the ImageKit Performance Center, you can have automated performance monitoring right on the desktop and mobile devices. You can use coupon code SHOPTALK for $100 in free credits, and it starts absolutely free at ImageKit.io. Our thanks to ImageKit for sponsoring this episode of Shop Talk Show.
Well, there is some browser news. I mean, I guess the big one is there's a build for Edge on Chromium. You're a Windows insider, certainly. Have you ran it?
I am running Edge Dev and Edge Canary on my laptop. And
nice. Hey. And you were kind of a fan of Edge before this. So do you like it more now or is it just as fast?
I was an Edge user. For all intents and purposes, it's Chrome, but it looks better, if that's kind of cool. I saw a little slide somewhere. I can dig up the tweet for the show notes, but they removed something like 50 APIs from Chrome, so which are kind of like Google-specific APIs, you know, Google Now and OK Google or whatever, you know.
Sure.
So I don't have any of those services running inside my browser. I think it makes it a little more lightweight. I've seen like people showing their task manager, you know, like how many processes and threads. And it's like, you know, it runs 3 threads where like just opening Chrome is like 9 or 10 threads. So it's kind of, but the memory footprint
and
stuff.
The best version of Chrome.
Well, yeah, it might be the best version of Chrome, which is kind of wild. But I don't want to claim that because it's still in beta and, you know, it can always get worse as they turn things on. But but, you know, I like it in some ways, you know, I got my preferred dev tools because Edge dev tools weren't that great. They were good, but they were like, it was ported from IE9, you know, and then they just were like, oh yeah, we need dev tools. They shimmed it into Edge, I think, or like it carried over, but it was kind of a, you know, it just, the user experience was a little clunky, you know, and it didn't have everything you needed. So I would always end up in Canary, like web inspecting and auditing and getting even just the kilobytes that we're sending down, like in the network panel, like that's helpful to me. So I always ended up going back and forth there. So anyway,
now you get Sweet DevTools. So they just came along for the ride right away.
Huh? Yep. Sweet DevTools. They added a own custom theme. So it's actually that's better for sure. So anyway, so now I have all these features. I'm feature compatible. Like I have Houdini now, which is why, you know, like all those cool demos, I can see them without opening up another browser. That's cool. So in some ways, I mean,
what's the UA? Is the UA weird?
What do you mean? Like just the feel or the tabs and stuff? Or?
No, I mean like literally the string. Oh, it's for browser.
Yeah, no, it says Edge, but it says EDG right now. Egg.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's
really
funny.
Is that on accident?
I think it was on accident. But,
oh no.
I'm sure they'll fix it. They have time to fix it. But I think,
well, even if the, I guess.
I think a bunch of like browser nerds, like Mike Taylor's and people who like UAs, user agents who live in that world. They were all having a laugh because they were like, "Nope, this is canon. We're doing it. It's called Egg now or whatever." So, anyway, Egg browser on Chrome, it's good. Survivor's guilt, is that maybe what I have, Chris? Where I you know, there's like, I have a better browser now. Edge was great. I really liked it. But I have maybe a better browser just because it has all the Chrome features now, you know. But the sacrifice is HTML as a whole loses another rendering engine and a JavaScript engine. So, like, the web lost an engine. So, how does that make me feel? A little sad, but in some ways, my browser.
We lost a closed source engine.
We lost a closed source engine. So, maybe that's a good thing, right? Like, So that's I mean,
I don't know. I can't, it's not a good look to argue against browser diversity, and I'm not going to do that because you can't know the impact of that, but it does seem like probably some negative will ultimately come from that. But I don't know. It's a tricky world that, you know, we're run by, it's just complicated.
Megalocorps. I just saw, so Mike Taylor, speaking of, he's web compat at Mozilla. So he's web compatibility. Like, he tracks the differences in browsers and stuff. We should have him on again. But he was at Blink On. He proposed that Chrome maybe switches to Gecko. So why, you know, he just was throwing that out there. They gave a talk and they're trying to come up with a formula to measure the gap between browsers, whether that browsers create their own private API or browsers behind. So they're trying to measure the gap, like come up with a empirical number that they can all watch and measure the gap. The data, I guess, from this PowerPoint, I think the talk will go on later this week or something, but the data seems to show that the gap between browsers is widening. So between now Safari, Chrome, and Mozilla, the gap is actually widening.
The compat gap.
So just the number of features and stuff like that. So, you know, I know, and I think the question is, can Mozilla catch up, you know, like to Chrome's APIs, hundreds of Chrome devs and tens of Edge devs and
Opera. Well, isn't this the thing? Like, this, it's, you can't, a new company can't just roll in. I mean, they could, but here's what it would take. You know, for a new company to roll in and be like, we're going to make a browser too from the ground up, JavaScript engine, every part of this browser, we're going to re-engineer and we're going to do it to spec. And our intention is to beat you and do a better job than you've been doing before. That is an absolutely incredible engineering effort. Just unreal. What it would take to do that. And at the end of it, it's got to be free. You can't charge a penny for it because the competition doesn't. So what's going on there? Like, how is the world of business going to ever do that, ever?
Yeah.
They're not going to do it. It's not going to happen.
No. I mean, and the like economics doesn't work, you know? And they, you know, somebody could maybe fork KHTML again or something and make WebKit some alternate WebKit universe.
Forks is where it's at, right? But the fork land hasn't gone super good, right? Opera goes, hey, we're going to just use Chromium 2, and now they're just gone. You know,
well,
I mean, yeah. I shouldn't say that because I have a piece of Opera news on.
I go back and forth, right? I'm trying to. Dave Rupert in 2019 is trying to be a little less sided in his hot drama, but
sure.
trying to dial that back and be a little more inclusive. But the one thing I think we have to acknowledge is the mobile web, right? And I think Mozilla's attempt to build a mobile browser that, you know, memory constraints, chipset constraints, all that has been unsuccessful, I would say. You know, they have the like feature phone, but they don't have like a smartphone, if that makes sense. So, in the future, I think is mobile. It's going to be low powered chipsets. I mean, even our Apple laptops are kind of converging on a cheaper chipset. You know, I think Windows is supporting ARM chipsets now. You know, like I think like the days of this Intel Infinite CPU is kind of going away. So I think we have to think like if a browser were to start like snap today and start, I think its focus would have to be only on the mobile experience or something like being fast.
And, that'd be kind of rad. Yeah.
So this idea of desktop, I think it changes everything. I mean, I think, you know, I'm going off of clients and their kind of stats too.
It's interesting that the thin client browser hasn't really, I shouldn't say hasn't really, it wasn't that Opera mini or mobile at one point was like that. And that's what the Silk browser was supposed to be. And, or I think it is still or whatever. Yeah. Why put the pressure of computing on the device itself when we can obviously put much more powerful computers in the cloud? So let them do the work.
I don't even know. Maybe there's just features that don't exist. Like, yeah, it doesn't do geolocation because that murders batteries or something, you know, like, but that doesn't make sense like in a mobile context. But I'm just thinking browsers have to be mobile to even exist in 2019. If that makes sense, like that has to be a feature. I think it's obvious that maybe Edge, based on some of the announcement stuff that they did, like Edge maybe wasn't hitting their like mobile goals or whatever, or IE was shoehorned on Windows phones. But it, you know, like it doesn't seem like it was a mobile compatible browser, if that makes sense, an AMD chipset compatible browser. The, you know, I think Gecko is having the same issue, although they've like replatformed entirely. It's pretty cool. But I think they have a lot of work to get to that, you know? So I think in 2019, it has to be mobile. And I think that also impacts our front end frameworks. Like Angular is a very desktop centric framework. React, kind of desktop centric framework. Vue, kind of a desktop centric framework. I mean, and I'm saying this, like, I like these things, so I don't want to, and I'm using them and recommending them. That's not it. It's just like, I don't think we've embraced the mobile reality of very crappy phones. So that's it. That's my diatribe. I will transcribe it and put it on my blog.
Yeah, there's a little less incentive to put a lot of engineering effort behind a mobile browser when iPhones don't have it, which I know is a little not the point, because low powered, Apple's never going to make a sub $100 phone, you know, which is, so who cares, I guess. Maybe it is worth doing, you know, from the ground up Android specific browser. I don't know. That feels like a question I'm not qualified to answer. But. So what's up with Opera though? Aren't they kind of like, we need to compete now? I mean, we don't have our own browser engine anymore. And now that we don't, we probably save a bunch of money. Mm-hmm. So we can use that new money theoretically to do interesting things. I remember it wasn't so long ago they were promoting Neon, Opera Neon. And I remember downloading it and I was like, this is kind of cool. It's like, maybe this is, you know, I'm always fascinated when browsers do something big and bold and different with themselves, you know, mm-hmm. and offer us some kind of, they compete on a feature that isn't standards. They compete on something else. I think that's cool. And I remember kind of liking it. Like, I wasn't convinced to use it all the time because it wasn't very developer-y, but it looked good.
It was almost like an OS, right? Like, it was, Opera Neon was like almost like web plus social, like you had like your social media accounts were like heavily featured, and you could even do split screen browsing inside your browser. So it was kind of like cool. Like it was like, oh yeah, you want split tabs? Here you go. Like here, you can split tabs. And so, I thought it was very cool, but they have a new,
and they marketed it right. They said, this is what Opera could be someday. It wasn't saying this is the new version of Opera, get used to it. But then now they have, you know, that was that years ago at this point?
2-3 years ago.
Yeah. Well, now there's Opera introduces Reborn 3, the first desktop browser with Web 3, which is, you know, I'm definitely not qualified to talk about. It's got a faster VPN, which is actually a really cool feature, I think, and a built-in ad blocker, I guess, which is unique for a desktop browser, isn't it, to have an ad blocker built in? Not that.
Yeah, I think Chrome, it's on the table, and Safari kind of Safari has the ability to add content blockers, but I think Firefox is betaing a content blocker by default, I think. So, and Brave would have it.
So this is in the zeitgeist right now for sure, is that browsers are trying to get ad blockers just right in there. It's funny that Chrome is messing with it. They're like, "Well, we're going to block stuff other than our own stuff, obviously."
Yeah. Oh, it just so happens DoubleClick gets a free pass. So, whoops. But I think this is cool. I think, you look at like paving the cow paths, like everyone has a Adblock Plus installed almost, or Ghostery or something, these are very these are very critical features for users. So I think it makes sense for browsers to offer these,
Well, it's got,
there's also, I looked into this Web 3 thing because this is the feature they're branding, right? Web 3.
Well, and I think decentralized is the key word, right?
Yeah. So I think it was kind of like Web 2 was social, and so, user generated content was kind of the big thing about Web 2 and Ajax, which go hand in hand, right?
Like, so these don't mean anything. These are just like, this is like the world trying to decide what millennials are.
Yeah, I bet it's some weird version of the web, weird corner of the web that talks about this, and they're like, yeah, that is it, but we're not in that corner, even though we build the web.
Okay, so if you are in the corner of Web 3, what are you?
I think it's decentralization. So part of the social movement was like, oh, MySpace and Facebook and Twitter and Medium. And so we all started like centralizing our content into, 10 different sites, basically. So this is more about decentralization. So they're like introducing kind of decentralized, technologies like blockchain. There's a crypto wallet inside your browser. I don't know if that's like, oh my God, to me, because I'm not really on the crypto train, but I guess it's neat. I guess it's neat that like, hey, if we're going to be a browser.
It is kind of neat. Yeah, right. Because, any kind of payment feature that's in the browser that makes it it isn't just there for show. It really does make it easier to check out in some way and buy things. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. And so you're kind of like, hey, what if the web, but you don't even have a bank anymore? That's kind of neat. That's kind of neat. I don't know.
I still have it. Like, what's the big question? Like, if you had to answer right now, Dave, is 10 years from now or whatever, is cryptocurrency bigger than it is now? Or was it a fad and it's gone now?
Ooh, I don't know. Can I say it's a safe haven for criminals? So it'll probably always be around.
Yeah. I feel like if you asked me like a year ago, I would have been like, okay, it's a fad. It's not going to replace money. Money is too big and too important and too not USD, like banks, like as it exists now, the existing infrastructure is too powerful for this new thing to take hold and this event, crypto eventually go away. And now I feel like I've changed my mind a little bit. Not that I'm ready to buy in on it entirely, but I feel like the movement is too big to go away. Also, I think crypto is too big.
Well, that's what the people on Reddit want you to believe, so that their crypto goes up in value. But that's also, I think there is something to be said. Like, I'm out of my tech punditry element here, but I think there's something to be said of like this is this is money if we all agree to it. So, you know, and we can use it and there's no banks involved.
Doesn't there have to be like one or two that win though? Like not 50? Or would a crypto person tell us, oh no, it's perfectly acceptable that there's 50 different ones or 1,000 different ones? I'm sure there's already well over 1,000 different ones.
And I think those people just, you know, arbitrage against each other, and that's what raises the value. You know, it's like, oh, Litecoin's up, I'll just sell this and buy Bitcoin, and now Bitcoin's up and now I'll sell this and buy Litecoin, you know, or Ethereum or whatever. The thing that bothers me, and this is probably like, this is my old manisms, you know, like if all the money disappears from my crypto wallet, I want to call somebody and yell at them. You know, you don't get that, you know, but if all my money disappeared from Wells Fargo, I could at least call somebody and yell at them and be like, what happened? You know,
yeah, so right.
That as far as like money goes, that's sort of what that would be a concern of
mine. Why don't you need a centralized thing to make it like if your stuff is in Coinbase, well, it can't go away because then you just log into Coinbase and it's still sitting there, even if your hard drive failed or whatever. But then it's centralized, and then what's the point, right? I don't know. I don't get it. But is there any actual technology that is Web3? When Opera 3 says, we got Web3 built in now, is that meaningless? Is that, it doesn't mean anything. It's not any more built in than Chrome or Edge or anything else.
Yeah, I think it's just the features, and the features are coming through. You know, it's this idea. I think they said crypto wallet, it has a VPN built inside, so you can just turn on VPN. Which is kind of cool, actually. I like that. Mm-hmm.
There's some crypto built in, so Web3.
I have a tinfoil hat. I just, you know, it's sometimes worth it.
Are you VPN all the time? Are you on a VPN right now?
No, but I, you know, it'd be nice to have that option or whatever. Or if you wanted to watch a show on the BBC or something, you know.
It's too weird of a word because mine is on right now, but it doesn't do general web traffic. It just does specific stuff, you know. I downloaded one for Firefox the other day because I wanted to test, you know, like what does it look like to look at a specific site from a specific country? And, you know, these VPNs are often like, take a look at your site from Canada or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was, there's just some plugin. I don't even remember what it was, Hax or Han or I don't know. I just installed it and signed up for an account, which totally didn't spam me or do anything fishy at all, and it was a nice little plugin with decently good UX, and I picked the country I wanted to visit the site from, and it worked great. And I'm like, yeah, dang, these VPNs are getting good, easy to use. Like, it's hard to believe it's free, but it is.
I mean it seems helpful, but I guess I'm interested in the future, like of where things are going for browsers. Even if we all have Chrome under the hood, I'm curious where it goes. I noticed, so Edge in their, I think it's their Android browser, Android Edge, which is just Chrome web views or whatever, Chrome under the hood. They actually offer like a AI product in there that's like a fake news detector. What do they call it? But it's basically like, it'll give you like a green badge up in the top, almost like a SSL thing. That's like, hey, this is actually like, this is a trustable source of news or something like that. So let me find what it's called so people can Google it. I'll
can't look in news because it's only about this Chromium thing.
Yeah, it's only about Chrome.
I like to say I was Captain Whiny about not getting any news about this while it was happening because there was never a date put ever on this release. It was just we're going to do this at some point. And then one day it's like, okay, we did it. And it was a lot of months in between those things, to be fair, right? Like there really was no date ever put on. No, you don't blame people. It's not like we need dates, but it was annoying to me because it was like, how soon is soon? Is it years? Is it months? Is it days? Because some of these things are like, you'll get a Jira ticket or whatever. Not that I use Jira, but people do, that says like, hey, there's an Edge bug. Do you fix it or not?
I'm glad to see this out and it's mature. I mean, it's basically Chrome with, you know, a few different features or
so it's what everybody thought so. It was going to be like it's no, yeah. No surprises.
Yeah, it's cool. And I mean, they have a weekly channel, so you don't get Edge updates every 6 months, or I guess you would get it every 3 weeks or whatever. But so it's going to update a lot faster too as features get ready, and it'll be on par with Chrome for the rest of eternity, or well, I guess until they fork or whatever. But anyway, the feature is called NewsGuard. I just wanted to say that I found it. NewsGuard Edge Mobile, and it's basically like a fake news fighter. So anyway,
that check is it out. Great. I like that.
Yeah, I'll post a link in the show notes here.
This episode is also brought to you by Netlify. We've talked a lot about Netlify Build before, the Git workflow for web development, where you can build, deploy, and manage modern web projects super easily with Netlify. They just launched something new they're calling Netlify Dev, where you can run their entire platform right on your laptop, or your desktop, I suppose, too. You can preview it all, site generation, functions, and edge logic. So imagine the productivity boost of being able to locally test your site generator, API integrations, serverless functions, and edge rules all in a single development server. That's Netlify Dev, a powerful way to build and test modern web apps on your local machine. With one simple command, you can install Netlify Dev to use on any project. That'll spawn a fully local environment of Netlify Dev that automatically detects and runs your site generator, makes environment variables available, performs edge logic and routing rules, and compiles and runs cloud functions. The extra bonus is that you can even stream that live, so Netlify Dev takes hot reloading to a whole new level, allowing you to actually stream your dev server to a live URL, which is great for collaborative development. You can now share your work as you work and get instant feedback. So I could be working on my site, I could have it open in a browser, open on my phone, see the changes live as they're happening, but you could also have it wherever you are in the world, open on your browser or on your phone, and whenever I update something, the site will update and you'd be able to see it. Netlify Dev automatically detects common tools like Gatsby, Hugo, Jekyll, React Static, 11D, and more, providing a zero config setup for your local dev server. Netlify has faithfully replicated their powerful Edge Logic engine in WebAssembly so you can locally test all the same rules before deploying them to their global infrastructure. You can write cloud functions in modern JavaScript, adding needed dependencies. Netlify will compile your functions as AWS Lambdas and deploy them as full API endpoints. Local testing works too. It all comes with Netlify Live, a hosted service that continually runs your dev command, just like you do locally, watching for changes. The result is an instant preview you can share with your entire team with live updates as code and content changes. Like I said at the beginning, Netlify Dev installs with the Netlify CLI, create new sites, set up continuous deployment, and push new deploys right from the command line. And Netlify Dev is just the beginning. Take your local development to Netlify Build, power collaboration through Netlify's Git-based workflow with deploy previews, branch testing, and more. So check out Netlify Dev at netlify.com. And our thanks to Netlify for sponsoring this episode of Shop Talk Show.
There was an article I think I linked to not too long ago. It was from March by Ian Bicking. It was called "The Firefox Experiments I Would Have Liked to Try." And it's a wonderful article because it was about Google Test Pilot or Google Lab, or not Google, Firefox Test Pilot, Firefox Labs or something, kind of shutting down or something. But they had all these experiments that were kind of like add-ons for Firefox that did special stuff. And the reason I love this so much is because it's like insight into like what browsers could do for us but aren't. Like, there's a lot of innovation that browsers could do that, not really at the standards level. Like, you know, hey, we do border radius differently and it's better. Like, that's not the kind of fighting browsers should do. And that's well established and we should hold them to that for now and forever. Because that's the worst thing ever for the web. But it doesn't mean they can't do extra stuff on top of that to make a browser awesome. So, like, and there was, you know, there's dozens and dozens of these ideas in here that were a part of this, you know, Firefox test pilot thing that are super clever. That are like, I want to try all these, you know. One of them was called sticky reader mode, which is, you know, all these browsers have reader mode and you click it on for a website and then maybe you leave that website. But if you come back to that website and look at an article, why isn't it just already in reader mode? You've already told the browser that you prefer reader mode on this website. Like, maybe you like that, maybe you won't, but it's kind of a cool idea, you know. One of them is like navigational breadcrumbs. You click from one website to another website and then to a third and fourth website. Maybe you should be able to see a breadcrumb trail of that, you know, visually somehow, because that's kind of interesting.
Oh, God,
you know?
I would love that. I would love a little tree of all my webbing,
sure,
you know.
But it's just an interesting way to do it. I like this one, find plus one. You do a find on the page, and it looks at that page for the text that you're looking for, but it also does a request for links that it finds that look relevant on that page and does the find on that linked to page. That's kind of interesting idea, you know?
Wow. Yeah. Oh, man. I would love that. Have you ever tried to go through your browser history? Like, you're like, oh, man, my tab's crashed or whatever, and I wanted to go, like, look, find that file or find that thing I was had open for 5 days. It's so hard. I've done it like recently, like, and I would love like nesting. 'Cause you know, sometimes you're like, I was like 20 levels deep on trying to find something or if I search for something and then went through a query, I'd like to know that, like, oh yeah, that was that search for that, you know, Jira ticket or something. I don't care about the Jira flow, you know? So, but anyway.
What about, you know, like, what if you could save something kind of permanently, like not a bookmark, but, you know, kind of like how Pinboard does it or whatever, where they'll like promise to, when you bookmark something, that they actually archive it for you. So it's like your own personal little web archive thing. That would be kind of cool.
And yeah.
What if, you know, your bookmarks, you know, like it played nicer with other browsers. So you could open your bookmarks and it would show you your bookmarks in all your other browsers too, just in case you happen to hop around browsers, you shouldn't be like penalized for your bookmarks, you know. There's so many things like that, that it's like, I feel like, well, we should almost ask more of our browsers. Like, hey, I like that you work on cool APIs, but like make yourself better.
Yeah, no, I think that's going to be, I wonder if that's the next, well, I think it is the next feature. I mean, but I do think we need to figure out what we do about Gecko. I don't mean get rid of it. I mean, bring it up to feature parity. But Mozilla is doing some cool things. They have like a VR browser you can download on Steam, and it's like a VR centric browser, you know, to compete, I guess, with, Oculus's Caramel browser, which isn't that popular, but like, yeah.
You know, it's what I don't particularly like, and maybe this isn't for a hip opinion either, though, is that like, I feel like there was a lot of messaging right when we got the kind of the news that Edge was dying that was like, we all should really, really switch to Firefox, like switch to Firefox. We need to bring Firefox up in this world. We can't let this happen to Firefox too, which is kind of like sympathy switching or something. Like they're like, we should do this, you know, just because, not because Firefox is better or because we should, but just because that's good for the web or something. And that's like not effective. I don't think that's necessarily gonna work.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you care about browser diversity, like put it on your number of cares, you know, carometer 1 to 10. Like if you care about it and you're a 10, I think you should, you know, I think, you know, I care about it and I switched to Edge just for that reason. And, you know, I suffered a bit, you know, I didn't see some, I missed out on some cool CSS tricks, I'm sure, some code pens, but like, but you know, I'm based on that experience, I'm not like, yeah, I want to just switch to another browser, you know, but Firefox is good now. So I don't even think it's like a
you're not
penalty really to switch. You know what I mean? So,
yeah, I don't necessarily think that it's a penalty to switch either. But if you think it is, or if you're, it just feels weird to be like, I'm willing to just hurt my life in this really arbitrary way just for, because I think that maybe browser diversity is good. But you're not a maybe if you're a 10 is what you're saying. Like if you're a 10 and you're
if you're a 10, do it. I think you should. I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons, you know. I mean, I think there's also like, if we all just use Chrome and we all just think of Chrome and we all, you know, I think that creates that browser monopoly, you know. It just reinforces the monopoly, and then, you know, people are mad something doesn't work in Firefox or Edge, you know, rather than understanding. So like vitriol gets cast on these hardworking developers because whatever, it doesn't support some weird API that only Chrome supports, you know? So I think that's bad for, you know, that is bad marketing for other browsers, but it's not their fault because it was like, yeah, we just didn't invent off screen canvas. Like, so it's not our fault. Like they didn't tell us about it. They just put it out there and now we have to do it. So, you know, that's all. I think there's I think there's a lot of reasons people should switch and try different platforms, go Linux, go Windows, go everything. But because I think if we just have a monoculture, we suffer, you know.
So it would be interesting to read somebody's like fictional, you know, like browser based sci-fi novel. Mm-hmm. About what it's like in the future where there's only one browser.
All right.
Is it really dystopia, or is it like, what's the worst thing that could happen in this? And again, I'm not trying to.
Okay. Say imagine that nothing bad can happen. But. One company tracks every movement you make on the internet. Just imagine that. And then they monetize you based on that. Oh, just imagine that.
Yeah. Nobody else has any permission to do this. They've locked out anybody else's ability to innovate on this. Yeah.
They've basically innovated so much that no other browsers can catch up. And therefore, this one surveillance capitalism company now controls the web. In all of its features, in all of its amps, all the pages, you know, they control HTML, you know? So what is that future? You know, we just do what this one browser says, you know, like that's not a good future for the web. So if you're a developer who likes to make JavaScript sites, you know, man, they might turn JavaScript off on you. Who knows? So it's a power consolidation, you know, that's why it's why Microsoft in the early 2000s sucked. I mean, they were like, yeah, we're the top dog. We hit like 90% of the market with Internet Explorer. So you get what you get. You don't throw a fit. So everything's built on ActiveX now, which is a thing we invented, you know? So.
Yeah. Like it's not like it doesn't feel theoretical. It feels like if this happens, it just will be worse.
I think, yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I'm just, again, I have a giant tinfoil hat over here. It's just the biggest, it's a samurai helmet made of tinfoil. But I think there are browsers that do this currently. And I think they have all the best intentions. They are nice people that work for that browser. That's not they do make the web better. But I think, too much power corrupts. Does that sounds like something a Greek philosopher said. So
we were at this, you know, once that point comes along where the power is tipped so strongly that way, which it's close, if not there, that if a feature comes along that people don't like, which is somewhat rare. Usually when new features come along, you're like, oh, cool. You've shipped Intersection Observer version 2.0. That's good. Only good things will come from that. But then, I don't know, who knows?
Encrypted media extensions.
Yeah, and then you're like, well, you don't like that. And you're like, well, absolutely, too bad.
Yeah, yeah. We encrypt, you know, you can't even download an image now because we use encrypted media extensions on images. So you can't even make memes because we care about copyright and we want Netflix. So we want Netflix users on our browser. So, you know?
Yeah.
It's already happened. If it hasn't, you know, that's my thing is like, we're already tiptoeing in that future. So I think if it matters to you, again, like use Firefox but don't just like, here would be my other advice. Don't just talk about Chrome. Don't just be like, oh yeah, Chrome's the devil man trying to take your data. I don't think it helps to set them up as a straw man or a boogeyman. You know, I think we need less boogeymen in the industry, but I think the way you win is you talk about the cool stuff in Firefox and you, for lack of a better word, evangelize that stuff. And you just say, this is cool. Or say like, oh, you know, I mean I can't see it. I'm on Firefox is such a bummer, but that's also like a good way to like nudge people into like the, hey, make it work in Firefox sort of thing. So.
It feels weird to just answer some simple little question about.
Let's wrap it up.
Border race or something. So let's wrap this one up, and we'll see you next week. Next week will be Dave and I as well, and then we have some guests lined up and some more ideas. So,
all right. Well, thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcast of choice. Be sure to star heart favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter @ShopTalkShow for tens of tweets a month.
Hey, Shop Talk Show listeners, do you want to work on NASA projects? Do you want to be a front-end developer for space exploration projects? That sounds like the coolest job ever. The MRI developer team is a close-knit group of passionate developers looking to track down problem spaces at NASA, then design and implement solutions to meet the requirements that space demands. Oh, that's so awesome. But, you know, they need a front-end developer here. So we're talking about a Vue job. Work with Apollo GraphQL, which I think is highly appropriate and funny. TypeScript, HTML, CSS, SAS. You work in Git and just have a passion for learning new things. You know, they say, we love all development and leave the dogmatic approaches for other teams to argue about while we implement solutions to drive human space travel exploration forward. We strive to use the best tool for the job, regardless of the technology. Surely like NASA itself. And if you have some experience with, you know, like Docker and continuous integration and the Cypress testing framework and stuff like that, that's great too. And to be, the ability to work effectively remotely. How great is that? Don't you want to work on space exploration projects with your front-end developer skills? That job is in Houston, Texas at MRI Technologies. Check them out. We'll have a link to the job with how you apply to it and all that stuff in the show notes for this show.
And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
ShopTalkShow.com.